This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Jewelry can say many things on your wedding day. As a wedding band, it can say, "This is a forever symbol of our forever love." As a gift to your wedding party, it can say, "Thanks for standing up there with us." Blue Nile can help you find the piece that says it all and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com.
Today on Sticks In, we recap the PLL weekend. We're talking all the face-off fallout, if you want to call it that. Some of the big plays that happened. We're going to look at kind of each team a little bit and the results that they had over the weekend and kind of where they stand as we anticipate approaching the greatest PLL weekend of the year, Connecticut. If you're enjoying the pod, please do leave a like, leave a positive review, 5 stars, subscribe, downloads, whatever, all those things that your podcast platform lets you do, please do those things. And make sure you head over to sticksinlacrosse.com and check out some content that's up over there now. There's a piece up now about some of the challenges that come with PLL coaches also being PLL GMs and, you know, the way they have to negotiate evaluating talent and finding new players. So by all means, go check that out. But for now, let's get into it. Thank you again for coming back. Let's do it. Welcome back to Sticks In. It's Tuesday. We are only a few short days away from the best games of the PLL season, the ones that occur in the great state of Connecticut. Obviously, as a lover of all things Nutmeg State, somebody who spent my entire life here, I'm going to do my best to share Connecticut-themed content sort of on social all week to kind of just share my favorite things about lacrosse in Connecticut, how great Connecticut lacrosse has been for a very, very long time here in our little corner of New England. I hope you saw today, I shared, as I love doing this time of year, the stats from C.J. Costabile's absolutely remarkable senior year of high school at New Fairfield, where he ran the offense with a pole and he never came off the field, and had almost 70 points with a pole in one season. So we'll try and have content like that about great players and coaches and other sort of legends of Connecticut history. On top of that, I'm going to try and have written content on the site every day this week, starting today, Tuesday. There is a piece up now about the Chaos in particular and their very strong connections to the state of Connecticut, including having 3 Connecticut Hall of Famers as part of their club, including the aforementioned C.J. Costabile. That's up now. That piece also shouts out some other guys across the league, not even just on the Chaos, but who are from Connecticut, do our state proud, you know, including guys like Peter Dearth, Connor Kelly. So please do go check that out and look out. Like I said, Connecticut content on sticksinlacrosse.com every day this whole week as we lead towards the games this weekend in Fairfield. Some will be our current players, some kind of legends of the game. Of course, I'll have a little something about if you're coming to Connecticut or if you're looking for stuff to do, places to go while you're here, some places you can go eat, some places you can check out, some other cool stuff while you're here for PLL games. So keep eyes out, keep visiting sticksinlacrosse.com and look for that. Looking back to the games in Minnesota from the weekend, obviously the story kind of all week was the face-off thing. Let's just spend a couple minutes, I guess, here on that before we get into individual games. The crux, the jump-off point, the big thing that kind of set everybody off talking about it was the word that the Water Dogs were not going to dress a face-off specialist. I'm sure everybody, when Greg Gerenlian tweeted that a club wasn't going to do it, he never mentioned the club specifically. I don't think I ever mentioned either, but the whole world was like, yeah, it's the Water Dogs, right? Like, yeah, y'all guessed right. It was the Water Dogs. They did not dress a face-off specialist for the weekend. That's a week after those Ohio games, or not a week after, but, you know, a game after those Ohio games, where they had success forcing Baptiste to go backwards and trying to limit the Atlas by using Eli Gobrecht to just eat up shot clock, essentially. They took a step further this past week on that strategy and said, we don't need a specialist at all. We're going to do that the whole game. We'll take the extra midfielder. Thank you very much. So there was a piece up at sticksinlacrosse.com where I kind of went back. When it became that this was going to be a thing that happened, I really wanted to understand the way it impacted the game, and not just the 32-second part. Because I know Paul Rabel had the long thread about it, and Joe Keegs has dug into the difference in offensive efficiency between 32 and 52 seconds. But what I wanted to look at was the strategy being deployed itself, which was what happens when the faceoff is forced backwards and a team has to clear or a team loses time as a result. So that Atlas Water Dogs game was the first time where we could really see that strategy come into play. And what I found was, and again, this is one game's worth of data for that strategy, but, you know, looking at kind of, again, 200 faceoffs, I looked at all 8 games from the last 2 weeks before Minnesota because that's what was available. It became kind of clear to me that if you can routinely meaning basically every time, force the opposing faceoff specialist backwards, going back to their goalie, ideally, if you can force them all the way backwards, you can have a very serious negative impact on your opponent's offensive efficiency. And you do that because you force them to play with a very short shot clock and possibly without even having the opportunity to sub all of their offensive personnel onto the field. So that was kind of the thinking. For a closer look there, you can check out the piece at sticksinlacrosse.com. I think it got circulated pretty well. I heard from a few folks who said it made its way around some PLO locker rooms and stuff like that. So I was pumped to hear that. I don't know if everybody tried to deploy it or everybody over there thought I was insane. Either way, I was happy to help hopefully contribute to the discourse in any way that I could over the past week. But I think after the Minnesota weekend, there were some things that we can take away. Obviously, the Water Dogs did it again, as we said, this time even a more hardcore version. They didn't even dress the faceoff specialist. So they played against Chrome. Connor Farrell goes 18 of 19 facing off. He committed, you know, I watched him commit 3 in the first half. I know there were more than that. He had a pretty good sized number of turnovers. I didn't chart the faceoffs for the game the way I did for the other ones. And I'll get into why for that in a second. But the Cannons also did this strategy, copycatting what the Water Dogs did a week ago, and it worked for them too. It worked against Trevor again. So, and that's, I have to kind of check myself. It's not totally fair to say it worked against Trevor. It worked against the Atlas. We'll get into that in a second, but there's been kind of, the conversation has been, they're losing the faceoffs, they're winning the game. They're winning the faceoffs, they're losing the game. It's not that simple. It's not like the face-off is the only thing that's happening here. There are so many moving parts to those face-offs that it's really unfair to boil it down to the face-off number was super skewed, but they lost. There's so much more going on. But, you know, again, Cannons did it too. It worked for them. Baptiste, another massive day that the Atlas could not take and turn into a win. So Water Dogs did this against Chrome. I am not sure they would have actually done it if it was any other team in the league. And I mean that. Any other team in the league. There's a few parts to this. And again, this is how you evaluate the decision to do it. It's not just, we'll just make their guy go backwards and win the game. There's a lot to think about. First, Farrell is not really highly rated or well-regarded when it comes to handling the ball and decision-making post-faceoff win. That's kind of been something about him that, you know, is been part of his game, for, you know, the last couple years. Last year, he was much, much better. His faceoff percentage was much, much better. And I got himself a new free agent deal because of it. But, I think a key part of the Water Dog strategy and the strategy that, you know, is being used kind of in general now is it's not just make the opponent go backwards. That's not enough. You have to force them all the way back to the goalie or into their D end, or you have to be very effective at forcing a turnover or hunting a turnover if they try and turn it upfield. So Water Dogs were clearly confident that they could do that. with Eli Goerbeck taking the faceoffs. They have very active pulls who are good and can run with somebody on the ball. And of course, Violet Veese and Zach Currier, very much helpful in that regard as well. They were intent on forcing Farrell into turnovers. If he tried to do anything other than go backwards, they were able to do it. That's a different decision against a lot of other faceoff specialists. Second, the Cromer missing JT Giles-Harris and Jesse Bernhardt. Are those two guys directly involved in a faceoff? No. But their absence means, and Copeland admitted as much of this on the broadcast, the Water Dogs are probably feeling pretty confident and they know they're going to have an edge in their matchups at attack, right? They're still putting Michael Sowers and Kieran McArdle out there against, you know, guys who, and this is not a knock on Greg Wild, who played very, very well, or other guys in the Chrome lineup, but they're not JT and Jesse. So the Water Dogs know that they're going to have an advantage at the attack, or they feel like they're going to have a pretty good edge. Their offense is going to be able to get some looks. That changes the math for you, because you know your opportunities on the offensive end are going to be pretty good. Finally, the Water Dogs do not turn the ball over very much. They're great on turnovers, but they create turnovers very well. Again, because of personnel like Ryland Veese, Zach Currier, Ben Randall. And the Chrome returned Brendan Nicktern last week. Yes, Nicktern, remarkable offensive talent. He's the reigning rookie of the year. That doesn't happen unless you're really, really good and a really special offensive player. Nicktern also did lead the PLL in turnovers a year ago. And this is his first game action back of the season. It's reasonable to expect some degree of, you know, if you want to call it rust or getting reacclimated to PLL game speed. So you kind of take all those things, right? Farrell being somebody you feel like you can force into a turnover, having an edge on offense with your attack, Nicktern being somebody who might cough the ball back up to you and create some opportunities and possessions for you that way. It's this nice kind of cocktail coming together for the Water Dogs' own personnel and the opposing personnel that creates the opportunity to say, maybe we don't need a faceoff guy. It's not as simple as just saying, ours isn't very good and we're not going to win, so let's do this. All those other things are considered too. And the stars kind of aligned for them this week. And it's most definitely not something they would do against everybody, or maybe not against anybody else. But this week, against that Chrome team, with the players that were missing and the players that were there and the Water Dogs' own personnel that was there, it made sense. It's a reasonable thing to do. The Cannons game, again, we're still talking faceoffs here. Cannons game a little more interesting because they did the same thing the Water Dogs did. They deployed Ethan Rall against Baptiste to force Baptiste backwards. Rall finished the day 0 for 17 with a ground ball facing off. You know, I put it on Twitter, and I do want to mention it here. I asked Pressler after the game about the strategy of the Cannons conceding faceoffs, and he did take issue with the word conceding. You can see the quote again on social, but, you know, the basic gist is this: it's the pros. These are pro-level competitors. The idea of conceding anything should not be something that's really in their mindset. I get that. I totally get that. These guys do not want to lose at anything. It's why they're pro-athletes. It's why they're pro-coaches, because they just hate to lose. They do not want to ever lose. So the idea of losing on purpose, i.e. conceding, is just, you know, it's a non-starter to them. At the same time, it's hard to look at 0 for 17 from a non-faceoff specialist going out there and saying anything other than the Cannons were saying, you can have the ball, you just need to go that way with it. And to me, that's a concession. So, you know, I will try to not use the word concede as much if the pros don't like that I do that, but it's still kind of the way I think of it. Either way, it had the desired effect again. This week, the Atlas adjusted, I thought, better. They began to play Jake Richard a close defense, basically, and break him upfield immediately from inside the arc as soon as Trevor picked up the ground ball. So the way that kind of works is Trevor can tell Jake, all right, I'm going backwards and I'm going this way. You start line up over there and you're breaking up field basically as soon as you can leave the box and just beat an attackman out. Just be a step ahead of an attackman and we're good. So Trevor gets to win the ball backwards. He picks it up. He flicks it to Jake, who's already running up the field. And it looks like a quarterback kind of, you know, doing a toss play to a running back. He flips it to him. He's already moving forward. His momentum's taking him up the field. He's running by an attackman. He's out. Atlas are cleared. You're good, right? One thing I kind of wanted to see them try, I think I said it on social too, but I would like to see if they didn't use Jake, but you know what? Use Romar. put Romar on close defense. He's like the fastest guy in the universe anyway. He's an offensive weapon for you that doesn't need to come back off the field. You can do it with Costa Beal too. Trevor face off, Costa Beal on one wing, maybe Danny Logan on the other. It could even be Brendan Curry. And Romar at, you know, at close defense, not with a pole, with his stick. Trevor wins it backwards, flips it to Romar, and because Romar is basically the Flash, he takes the ball and is over the midline in the blink of an eye. There's not an attackman who's going to cover him. And he's over, and then once Romar is over the midfield line, he's on offense. He's got the ball in his stick, possibly with a transition opportunity. The other midfield players in the game with him are Brian Costa Beal and Danny Logan. You got to sub one guy there if you want to sub him at all. You don't even have to sub Danny Logan if you don't want to. And then either way, Trevor just subs off the field from your defensive end to get your close defender back on. You've got 6v6 offensive personnel out there. You probably have 20 plus seconds on the clock that way. To me, that's like a drastic improvement in the amount of time you have and the personnel you have on the field if you do it. So that's not something new. That's not something that like was invented recently. 40 years ago, around here in Connecticut, people were doing that. People were doing it to deal with Andy Towers in high school, to be frank. But, I think as the weeks go on, it's something you might see more of. You saw it with some D-MIDI personnel. Teams might get really nuts. Try it with some O-MIDI personnel. I know there's always like the, but what if you don't win the face-off? Again, keep in mind that I won't say concede, but the other team is not trying to win the clamp. They are trying to make the face-off player go backwards with it. And their personnel is a pole facing off and two short stick D middies, or just a pole facing off another pole and a short stick D middie. They are expecting to play defense and ride. If they somehow win it, they are subbing guys, and you can sub with them. You get your defender back on that way. If they try and play offense with a pole and two short stick D middies, then they try and play offense with a pole and two short stick D middies on that 32 second clock that's so short and everybody hates so much. It's not like anybody's beaten Trevor clean that's a pole and trying to lose. The weird thing for me about it with the Cannons game was the Cannons bailed on their faceoff, I thought, pretty early. They had Bones Kelly in the lineup. Bones was 4 for 7 when they went to Rawl. So their specialist wasn't even really losing a ton and getting, you know, crushed. And they still decided to start trying to force Trevor backwards. Now, that was a little surprising to me. I know there's like there's tempo and winning certain amounts in a row within the game that obviously changed that, but it was still surprising to me to see he's 4 for 7. We're not going to try the faceoff anymore. Ethan Rawl, you take him. I talked with Patrick McEwen, Lax Film Room, who does awesome stat stuff for IL and a bunch of other places. But, he kind of crunched the numbers a little bit as we were in search of this breakpoint for when a team should theoretically start with the force the guy backwards strategy. Like, how badly do you need to be losing for it to make sense to start doing that? And the number that Patrick came up with, and I checked his math pretty well, it looked good to me, was honestly right around 50%. So basically, if you're not going to be the one winning them, then force them backwards and take your chances. The thing about it, again, with that is the Cannons weren't really getting cooked at that point. Like I said, Bones is 4 for 7. Two of those, he won forward. He smoked right out the front. But, you know, Baptiste kind of started finding a rhythm. I think he won 3 in a row, and that's when they bailed. So I was still a little bit surprised that the leash wasn't a little bit longer for Bones, given the way he started the game. At the end of the day, this is not the reason the Atlas lost. It's not the thing that did it. They lost because their defense looked awful. We'll get to this later, but, you know, the Cannons made their defense look like a wax museum, so that's why they lost. The second kind of impact, I think, of the development of the weekend of seeing this is I think you can foresee maybe, and it's like I hate to have to say it because it's you never want to expect for guys to lose their jobs, but job security for faceoff guys is low. Now, I don't mean teams are not going to carry one. Teams are going to, every team in the league is going to carry a faceoff guy. But maybe teams stop carrying two. If your two viable options on a faceoff are, in some order, my top faceoff guy, who gives us our best shot, and if he doesn't have it, we're doing foursome backwards. We're doing Ethan Rawl. We're doing Eli Gobrek. We're doing whoever. If those are the two best options on faceoffs with a 32-second clock, then there's never a need to roster two faceoff guys anymore. You can always just go with your guy or force him backwards. If you have an injury, obviously you put the guy on IR, on PUP, whatever, and you get somebody new. But two active faceoff guys where one of them is just not getting on the 21-man every week, there's no need for that guy. Keep defensive depth. Keep midfield depth. Keep depth somewhere else. Have your stud that wins them for you. And when he doesn't, you don't need to bother with somebody else. Just poll it, make him clear. It's great news for middies and polls. It's possibly a bunch of roster spots that open up, but if this becomes something that sticks around, that people really try and do, and I'm still very, very skeptical that it will stick around and be something that you see regularly. It's possible that, you know, teams just stop carrying two faceoff guys. A lot of teams have two. Teams are going to decide if they need them anymore. I don't think the no face-off guy dressed is a long-term viable strategy or an option. If the 32 seconds stays, goes, gets adjusted, whatever, this is not something you can do every week. Again, in order for it to work, you need the stars to align like they did for the Water Dogs. You need your opponent to not find a reasonable counter. And it's hard to count on something every week that you cannot control like that. You cannot control if your opponent finds the way to counter what you're doing effectively and you have to do something else. You need to be able to consistently do this for a game. You need to walk on the field knowing that you're not going to win faceoffs. And for a pro competitor, that's a tough thing to embrace, like to press their point. And that's the really smart part of it. These guys, you can't expect them to show up thinking I'm going to lose. It's just not a mindset any of these guys have. That's why they're pros. And then, again, you need to be able to force the opponent backwards, ideally all the way to the goalie, basically every time. If they go forward, it is not a positive outcome for you. It is not good. It does not change the math enough for you to be out there doing it every time if they keep winning it forward. The archers showed what happens if you have a guy who cannot be forced backwards and you try and do it. Sisselberger exited backwards every time. He popped the ball out backwards if they tried to face off with Squires, but as Coach Bates described him, he is a bowling ball. He picked the ball up and he turns upfield and he cannot be turned back and he handles pressure and he gets rid of the ball. He does not need to go back to the goalie. He can just run it out. And he was able to do that a lot. And if that happens, then the idea of, all right, he's going to go backwards and we're going to be okay, it's a lot less reliable. He essentially is just going forward with extra steps, right? It's maybe a second or two you're eating as opposed to the time of back to the goalie and clear and a ride to eat time. If any of those combination kind of start happening, you can't get all those things to work for you. You got to start finding a way to try to win faceoffs again, because you can't just go out there and let Sis go 24 or 27 and they're all going forward or right at the line and then forward. You know, I still remember when the Dolphins in the NFL, I'm sure plenty of people remember this. I don't know. Fans are young these days. If you're listening to this, you're probably in a demo that remembers the Wildcat offense with Ronnie Brown when they broke it out against the Patriots, the great Tony Sperano. It was new. It threw maybe the greatest coach ever in Bill Belichick and his defense for a loop. They couldn't stop it. It was this crazy new strategy. We're going to change up positions. We're going to toss out the traditional roles occupied by these guys. We're going to snap the ball directly to the running back. We're going to make you account for the quarterback who's now looking like a wide receiver. We're going to move everything around and we're going to confuse you. And it's going to be not something you're used to. And it's going to totally just make your head spin. And it allowed an underdog Miami team to beat a Goliath Patriots team. And for weeks after that first Wildcat game, the pundits on ESPN, the Stephen A's, the football guys that were on back then, right? Like the Merrill Hodges and those guys. The pundits were talking for weeks about the Wildcat. Could this change the way we play offense in the NFL? How is anybody going to counter this? Is this going to just totally, upset the balance of what offense looks like in football? And now it's a gadget set, basically. You see it sometimes at the goal line with very specific players. And even then, everybody's basically ready for it. It's not all that successful. These kind of face-off tactics, they remind me of the Wildcat. Right now, we're in that, it's not a honeymoon period, but we're in that kind of lawless, people are trying to figure out what to do with the face-off with this new clock period. And as a result, we're seeing some things that are kind of blowing minds a little bit. And we're saying it's changing the game. All those things, kind of, you know, come alongside a rule change that's basically still four games old. Is 32 seconds still a little too fast? Yeah, you know what? I think so. I think 32 is a little bit quick. I think most players would say that too. Should it result in a shift so seismic that face-offs go away? I hope not. I don't think so, but I hope not. I want the face-off to be around. Some of my favorite personalities in the PLL, my favorite guys to listen to in post-game, to do interviews in the game, all that stuff. You saw it this week. Great sound from Sisselberger, great sound from Baptiste. Both those guys, put a mic on them and everyone's having fun. Those are face-off men. You want those personalities on camera. So you want those guys to be around, having an impact, being stars of the game, and not kind of just the guy who's going to set a record every week, but his position doesn't impact the game much. Midweek, I said if you set the over-under on times the rest of the year where a team dresses no face-off man at 0.5 games, I think I'd take the under. I think I still might stand by that. In Connecticut this weekend, Water Dogs playing the Whips. Giving up face-offs to Lasala is a good way to lose the game. He will run by people and go forward with it the way Sisselberger did and score. He can handle pressure. He can run by somebody. It's not as easy to just force him backwards. And the Whips defense is still quite strong. Those other stars are not aligning for them this weekend. They might need to find another answer. I'm sure there will be plenty of face-off takes out there all week. It's become quite the hot topic. I like to think it's kind of my fault that it is, but not really. I didn't do any of this. But you know, again, it'll be like when the Wildcats showed up. Be hot takes out there about how it's going to change everything. Enjoy them, endure them if that's what's more applicable to you. Participate if you want to. Have fun with it. At this point, I am interested primarily in two things when it comes to the face-off stuff. When, in the course of a game, a team decides to bail, if they do, and do the pole thing, the Ethan Rawl, Eli Gobrek thing, and the way teams deploy their personnel on face-offs that they know they're going to win. Where are you putting your guys to beat the "we're making you go backward" strategy? That's what I want to see now, because that's the book is out there on what everybody's trying to do if they don't have a face-off guy out there. The whole world knows. It's not some big secret. We want you going to your goalie. That's what has to happen. But you can still be creative and look for new counters and look for new interesting things to do with your personnel elsewhere that we haven't seen yet. Like the thing with Romar, with the O-Midi on close defense. We really haven't seen that yet. Teams have been, I don't know if they're hesitant to try it. Teams do it with Richard Krohm, try and do it with Tarasenko, with guys like that, with more two-way guys. I'm telling you, if it's me, I'm going all in and doing it with an offensive midfielder. I'm not scared to try it. Anyway, it's enough face-off aftermath. That's way too much time on face-off fallout. On to the games themselves. So, first game of the weekend, Water Dogs 10, Krohm 7. We covered the face-off part. We're done with that. Water Dogs were also without Connor Kelly, which is important because he's such a weapon for them. He plays everywhere. I thought Jake Caraway looked outstanding running out of the box in this one. I think situations where he is like your last guy on and the first two subs on have pulled the defense away from the box a little bit and you kind of build Caraway a runway to get going downhill that way. There are moments like that. He had one early in the game where he just looked unguardable. He let one go in a situation like that. And it honestly looked like a walkthrough rep. It looked so effortless for him. Just dusted his man and pinged a far pipe. It looked like nobody else was on the field with him and he was just running a rep in the backyard. So I love the way Caraway looked in that game. Thomas McConvey makes his pro debut. He had a couple of points. He also had a couple welcome to the league moments. Got popped a couple times. A couple of turnovers of running into traffic that were a little ugly, but you see the part of his game that really shines. Kieran McArdle talked about it after the game. Kieran said, number one, he's huge. He's massive. It's how big he is, I don't think, has been appreciated yet. But number two, McConvey's versatility. Can do everything. Dodge, shoot, play anywhere on the field. You know, he can be an off-ball guy. He's got great hands. So you think he'll be obviously spectacular in the league. He's just such a fit for the Water Dogs in particular, who love guys like that, like a Connor Kelly, who can play anywhere and do any kind of thing for you. One benefit, you know, of again, you know, of the way the personnel went, and Copeland said it after the game, that extra midfielder for the Water Dogs made a difference. He said his four-man short stick D-mid unit was basically still fresh as the game was ending. That foursome, that group of, you know, of Witcher, Scarpello, Higgins, and Charlie Hayes, they combined to cause 3 turnovers and pick up 9 ground balls. That's a lot of extra possessions. That's where that game is, right there, in those extra possessions. And again, some of those extra possessions, if they're coming after a faceoff, are 52 seconds long, not 32. That kind of stuff adds up. Those ticks on a clock add up. It's just more time with the ball for you. You know, for the Chrome, Nick Turn had some really nice moments in his return. He did finish with just the 1 goal. No assists was kind of tough to see. He had 6 turnovers, though. And again, some of that's the Water Dogs. Some of that's Nick Turn rust. I thought Hanley bounced back pretty nicely in this game. You know, I had said early in the game I wanted to hear his name called more. I wanted to see him more involved. And as soon as I did that, I think he committed like 2 turnovers and wound up on the wrong end of a highlight on the end line where he got shoved out of bounds. But he flexed a bit in the second half. He finished with a pair of goals. There was some nice distribution, some nice head-up dodging from him, where he looked more like the player we kind of expected and like we saw at Penn. So, look, if he gets a short stick ever, it's his job now, the way I see it, to show that to be a mistake, to demand and command a pull and a slide all the time. He's that kind of dominant as a Dodger. I think, you know, you just want to make sure he sees that, and you want to see it translate on the score sheet. I'm sure he would say he doesn't care if he scores goals or not, but I think for the Chrome to be successful, he needs to be putting some in the back of the net. He needs to be taken over a little bit. And finally, Greg Weil, you know, a tough ask for him. Hasn't played in a PLL game. I don't think he didn't play in one last year. I don't think he's played in one since 2021. So the call to say, hey, we need you to come back this weekend, we need you to guard Michael Sowers, is a tough ask. And look, he didn't do too bad out there. 2 cost turnovers, 4 ground balls. He had a point. Both coaches, Sudo and Copeland, were very complimentary of his play at the end of the game. I think he distinguished himself well in his assignment. So, you know, it's good for him to put that kind of play on film if he's a guy who wants to be on the field every weekend, because he showed he's a 19-man regular level defenseman if he can win that matchup, or he can, you know, hold his own in that matchup. The Chrome, unfortunately, now reside at the bottom of the standings and will take on a red-hot Cannons team in Connecticut before the All-Star break. And as we mentioned, the Water Dogs will get a big test against the Whips in Connecticut before the break for Louisville. Next game was Cannons 19, Atlas 12. Marcus Holman scored his 300th career goal. He is the 4th player in MLL/PLL history to do that. 4, including him. That's it. You think of all those names out there, you know, it's pretty impressive to come in ahead of them. Marcus Holman's name doesn't get thrown around with a lot of those all-time great guys. Like the guys in front of him on the list right now are Brendan Mundorf, Paul Rabel, and John Grant Jr. That's it. There's a lot of other all-time greats, the Powells, the, you know, the Striebels, the one weapon after another out there. The guys going into the hall this year, the Roy Colzies of the world, and, you know, special, special offensive weapons and talents. You know, he passes guys like Joe Walters, who owns the record books. But when people have those conversations about those level of players, I feel like you don't hear Marcus's name nearly enough. You know, you hear he's a great shooter, he's a great scorer, he's all that, but he really is an all-time great, a pantheon player at the pro level. So congrats to Marcus on 300. Pinnell is a few goals behind him now. I think Pinnell was at like 280-something, 290-something maybe. They might end up doing that kind of, as long as they're both active, back and forth on the list until somebody hangs it up. But special players there, of course. Look, the Cannons are good. They're not overachieving. They're not better than we thought. They're not a scary underdog. They're not, you know, frisky, looking dangerous. Whatever other way you want to try and say in some way, shape, or form, I'll be surprised when they win. Stop being surprised. They are good. They are a good team. Asher Knowlton gave Gavin Adler all he could handle. Knowlton finished that game with 0 turnovers. That's pretty ideal from your primary ball handling attackman. And look, some of that is because the Canons did go elsewhere looking for initiators at times. They kind of stayed away from Adler in that regard. They tried to get Nolting the ball already moving when Adler had to take an approach to him so Nolting could kind of have momentum into the matchup and use his physicality there, and it worked a couple of times for him, but the idea of just like the straight dodge against a set-up Adler did not happen much because the Canons didn't want to bother with it. But look, looking for other initiators, they found plenty, right? Chris Islanian out there letting it rip, looking like a monster shooter in that one. Ryan Drenner wins his matchup every week. Matt Campbell continues to look outstanding. He should be getting a poll every week at this point. If you're not polling Matt Campbell, he's going to make you pay. Donville hat trick. Matt Kavanaugh turning the clock back, looking like Notre Dame Matt Kavanaugh on the ride. He was crushing it, caused two turnovers, and had 7 points. They were just humming. And I think they have something in their goalie in Colin Kearst. I thought Kearst made some nice saves. His athleticism continues to impress me. You know, out of the cage, running around. Look like a young Adam Gettleman out there. So if the season ends today, the Canons finish top four and they play in February. And what a job that coaching staff has done. And they deserve to say that coaching staff. I obviously have sung the praises of Holman quite a bit, but look, he always says he gives a ton of credit to Jim Mitchell and Mikey Thompson, and they deserve it because they've earned it. So, you know, for the Atlas, the defense looks a mess right now. It looks like six individual guys playing 1v6. And communication breakdowns, when you look at them play, it looks like they're happening regularly. You know, two guys saying, "I thought you had him, I thought you had him," kind of stuff off the ball. Help defense kind of winding up out of position. They just can't seem to stay organized. And at the pro level, that's going to get you shredded against anyone. You could grab guys out of the player pool. If you can't play good team defense, you're going to get shredded. So they get the Chaos next week, and an offense as good as the Atlas's is, and it's real good. An offense that good is not going to bail out a bad defense against Blaze Reardon and Jack Rowlett and the Chaos. They're going to need to get some stops. And if you can't guard guys off the ball, Dane Smith is going to carve you up. So the Chaos are a very good passing team. I know their goal total was low this week. We'll get to their game in a second here. But, you know, they scored 8 goals, 7 assisted. They share the ball. They move it. They make you guard everybody. And Atlas have to get ready for that this week. So that, you know, you kind of want to keep watching the way the Atlas tune that defense and get the off-ball defense figured out. On ball, I think they look good. Adler obviously wins his matchup when he has the opportunity to. Rex Rhodes good on ball. There's short stick D middies and Danny Logan, Peter Dirth. You know, those guys can guard people one-on-one. But the rest of everything, you know, you kind of want to see them just be a little more organized. I don't know if the answer is Kobe Smith. We haven't seen him yet, but you know what? Why not give him a try? Because you got to do something to kind of shake things up and get the defense right. Next game, Redwoods 13, Chaos 8. Just kind of mentioned the Chaos there a little bit. Chaos did give everybody a bit of a startle when they announced Austin Kaut as the starting goalie, and they were giving Blaze a weekend to hold the iPad. Kaut is a very capable goalie and played very well. It's just that nobody ever expects to see not Blaze Reardon between the pipes for the Chaos. Kaut made 16 stops, 55%. I know it's a losing effort, but that's pretty damn good for a guy who I don't think has made a start. Or, you know, the last start he made was in an MLL uniform. So, you know, post-game, obviously Towers got questions about it, and he explained it pretty well. He says, you know, look, it's in the first half of the season, particularly these first handful of games here, he feels like he and the coaching staff have an obligation to see everybody that's on their 25-man roster in game action, to evaluate them in game action, and so that those guys have game experience. By doing that, they're able to stand by their decisions and defend a 19-man roster as they get down the stretch into the playoff push and ultimately into the playoffs. So you could say, look, we saw these guys in games. We know when it comes to the game, this is our best 19 because we've seen everybody and we know that. So that's kind of the rationale there. You know, so that just kind of is what it is, I guess. The Chaos had plenty of looks in this game. Jack Kelly for the Woods played his ass off. You know, shots were about even. Face-offs about even. Ground balls tilted big the Woods way. And that's where the game got decided, I think. You know, usually if the face-offs are even, ground balls should probably be able to closer to even two. You know, you kind of expect one team has a big face-off edge. They also have the ground ball edge, as you can understand why that would happen. But if face-offs are even and one team has a big ground ball edge, it means possession gets big time tilted. And I think that's what happened here. The extra possessions just built them that lead that they needed. And then, you know, Jack Kelly and the Woods defense protected it. They kind of held their own, and Chaos just didn't have enough chances. They had plenty of good chances. They just didn't get enough of them because the ground balls were so tilted. So Rob Pinnell continues to climb that all-time assist chart, moved into sole possession of third all-time. Passed some guy named Casey Powell, who I heard was pretty decent. Only Joe Walters and Ryan Boyle remain in front of him on that list. Walters is only 7 assists ahead of Rob, so in all likelihood, Pinnell will move into second at some point this season. Boyle has 32 more assists, so it'll take a special year this year to catch him in 2023. But Pinnell's out there in 2024. You can put that all-time record very much on watch. Pinnell in this junior offense, this John Grant junior offense, has been able to do it all. He attacks from behind the goal with a level of effectiveness that he had in his MVP years. And for the record, those MVP years, maybe they're coming back because he belongs in that conversation right now. He actually showed off a little bit of range in this one. He was just inside the two-point arc, hit a low to high riser, you know. He and Ryder Garnsey are a duo that nobody seems to be able to handle the both of them right now. You know, after the game, Nat had said they know Rob and Ryder are going to be Rob and Ryder. And then they have sort of an idea of, you know, I had asked it about it as in the way of calling it like a usage rate, like you would see in the NBA, but an amount of touches they want to make sure they get for guys like Charlie Bertrand and Jules as well. But right now, Rob and Ryder look like a pair that just teams are having a hard time figuring out the both of them at once. It has been over a calendar year since Rob Pinnell had less than 3 points in a PLL game. Last time it happened was week 4 last year when he had 2. And when you consider the Woods offense last year and the changes to it this year, both in personnel and a new OC, it's a testament to just how fluid and how one size fits all Rob Pinnell's game is. Change the pieces, change the scheme. He fits. He is the peg that fits any hole. The Woods move to 3-1. They just keep on climbing. Somehow they've been an underdog every week on the books. I know there's like heavy juice. They're +1.5 at like -150, but they're still getting goals every week. I don't think that lasts that much longer. We'll see. And then our last game of the weekend, Archers 15, Whipsnakes 12. Archers move to the top of the standings. They are tied in record with the Water Dogs and the Redwoods, but they have the best goal differential in the league, so Archers are now your new number one. Whipsnakes tried the face-off tactic a little bit in this one. They used Colin Squires on 10 draws. Again, we covered this earlier, but it really wasn't effective because the Archers, they looked prepared with their personnel. They deployed their guys well, and the Whips just couldn't consistently force Sisselberger backwards far enough. He'd pick it up and turn and muscle his way over the field and get it to the attack. He handles pressure. He handles checks. He doesn't turn the ball over. He did not have a single turnover in the game. Oh, I'm sorry. No, he had one turnover. He went 23 of 27, took 3 shots, and had 1 turnover. If a faceoff guy is doing that, it means you weren't able to get everything to happen that you needed to happen for the strategy to work. He needs to turn the ball over too. In truth, it really is a picture perfect kind of game. The Archers kind of showed you exactly why it's not as simple as just putting a pole out there and make him go backwards. You can't make Sis go anywhere. This was another case, too, of Grant Amant missing as he works his way back from the hamstring injury. You know, Quint on broadcast mentioned speaking with Bates and that Bates had said if it were a playoff game, Grant would be out there. So that tells you they're being cautious. They're making sure it's 100%. With a hamstring, it's things that it just needs rest. And even if it feels good, it might not be good yet. So being cautious, I think, is a positive. We'll see if he gets the green light for Connecticut, or maybe if they just let him go and rest it and really be good through the All-Star break so he is ready for second half run into the postseason. Without him, the Archers still do their thing. I say it every week. The offense is built for them on the ball moving faster than the defense can. And in that sense, they can withstand injuries pretty well. Fields 5 points. Matt Moore goes to attack his natural position and looks excellent. 4 points for him. Another 2-pointer and a 4-point day for Mac O'Keefe. Another great defensive outing from Graham Hossack in particular was awesome. Dobson is looking great. He's going to be in that goalie of the year conversation. The Archers look as complete as anyone. The test is always the same for them now, though. Doesn't matter what the Archers do in a regular season anymore. They need to do it in September. And to that end, better make sure Grant Amon is healthy in September. For the Whips, they have yet to play a game with their full offense together. No Vambo in this one. Brad Smith's obviously been out for most of the first half, or most of this first, half of the season. That means that foursome that they anticipated of really changing the way their offense looked, Vambo, Zed, Dordovic, Brad Smith, they haven't played a game together yet. Stagg said post-game, they hope to have that group healthy, for the second half. He did kind of mention, with all those guys being out, that it's possible. He was very clear that he's not making excuses, but, there's when their offense has inconsistent performances, that's a reason why. The guys are kind of in and out a little bit. Dordovic had a pair of twos in this one, and he looks to be the rookie of the year front runner. He's very much been what it was expected from me, as a guy who can separate and is just deadly on the run, and a little bit of a volume shooter. What I did not have him as, and I don't think he really got the billing this way, even as a college, was 2-point threat, right? I mean, I don't think anybody expected when Dordovic got drafted to be like, look out for this guy from range. It was look out for the Dodger, the separation, that kind of stuff. The drawing of slides is what you're getting with Tucker Dordovic. I don't know if they really expected to get a guy who is currently leading the league in 2-point goals. He's tied with Connor Kelly. They both have 4. So just a little icing on the cake with the Dordovic pick there. You got yourself a 2-point score out of it. Rambo on pup, Earhart carrying a number of lower body injuries. They had to change the font size for Earhart on the injury report. There were so many injuries to list. Whips have had the injury bug hit them just really hard. Harder than anyone really this season, if you ask me. It's no surprise, again, that they've had some of those kind of inconsistent performances as guys come in and out of the lineup. Jack Myers, jettisoned by the Chrome after the draft, was picked up to play some attack with those guys out and looked fine. I thought he looked okay. He does not have that super high-end pro speed. He's not going to Michael Sowers past anybody. He's not the fastest guy in the universe. But he does use his feet and his body and his physicality very well to get to the spots on the field he wants to get to. He's very skilled with a stick, and he can get to where he wants to go. And above GLE, he's going to demand a double because he can shoot. And he's very skilled as a shooter. So, look, I don't know if he's going to be a star in the PLL, but he's going to compete for a spot. He can do that. He can, win a matchup with a PLL pole with physicality is enough to get you a spot on the roster. So I thought he looked pretty good for the Whipsnakes out there. He's certainly an option for teams who need some depth, particularly at X behind the goal. That's where he's going to be his best. I don't see him as a guy who's going to crush it running out of the box because it's just not kind of his kind of game. Connecticut. It's Connecticut week. The last regular season action before the All-Star break. The environment here in Connecticut is always outstanding. It was great last year. Of course, I will be in attendance both days. How could I not be? It's in my backyard. As I said, keep your eyes peeled for PLL/Connecticut-themed content in addition to usual weekly pieces. Power rankings will still be there. Weekend Primer will still be there. Try and have some more player features along with, check out that piece that kind of is cornered on Gibson Smith, but is really about the difficulties of having a GM and a coach be the same person. Got some more stuff like that coming this week. I am so happy it's Connecticut week. I'm looking forward to seeing you all at Fairfield University. Go buy tickets if you haven't. I'll see you there. Hit me up in the DMs. If you need some, maybe I'll try and help you out. But thank you again for sticking around with me, and we will see you at Rafferty Stadium this weekend.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.